You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where our paternity leave policy is apparently way too lenient. Because Daniel is out again with a quote-unquote migraine, the quote-unquote first one he's ever had in his life. I don't know. I'm your host, Justin Emelsneski. If you got a problem, take it up with him. You can find him on the Twitters, on the internets. I think he's on the Instagrams, too. I don't know. But joining me this trip from Dale's lawn, identifying as a woman to forgo his white male gay privilege, William Green.
Hello, hello. Happy Cyber Monday, Justin. You got any big purchases lined up for all the Cyber Monday deals?
I've already done all of my online shopping because, if you hadn't noticed, they stretch the sales out all week. There's no such thing as a Black Friday or a Cyber Monday anymore because it was all week. I mean, it was on Tuesday they started posting them, I think, where they were like, Cyber Monday came early. So I did everything already.
Well, that's good. I think I bought some knickknacks for my computer. That's really all I've purchased. But
wait, why does your computer need knickknacks? What does that mean?
Well, I need a new micro SD card. I needed another USB cable to replace a worn one in the living room. So just little knickknacks like that.
Oh, okay. Some accessories. See, when I hear knickknacks, I think knickknacks are like things that you don't really need, but you buy anyway. They're kind of like useless things. So you bought actually useful things.
I did. I heard a friend of mine bought one of those robot vacuums. I don't know if it was like a Roomba or one of the other alternative ones, but that was their big Cyber Monday purchase.
That's kind of cool. I bought stuff for other people that I knew I would have to buy for the holidays, so it would save me some money. And then also, I wandered into the Under Armour store on Black Friday because I was at the mall by accident. The movie theater that had a movie that was worth seeing was a mall. And then I was like, wait, it's Black Friday. And every store had lines except for the Under Armour store. So I went in there and I was able to get, it was 50% off the entire store. So I was able to get a couple Project Rock hoodies 50% off. So $40 from 80. And one of them is really cool. It has an American flag on the sleeve and it says respect across the chest. So I was pretty happy with that. And it's the first Black Friday purchase of my life.
And you used it to support the patriarchy. I love it.
Of course I did. And I think we're going to talk about that and more, right? In the news without Daniel T. Richards.
Well, I assure you, Mr. Listener, it really is that bad. These aren't harmless criminals. This isn't just a fad.
That's right. Our news today is without Daniel T. Richards, but you can still join our Patreon. So just go to patreon.com/themidside or themidside.com/patreon and give us a couple bucks for each episode. It really helps us keep the lights on. So our first story today, I tweeted that I couldn't stand Indian cuisine and started an international food fight. So this is by Tom Nichols, an opinion columnist. I don't like Indian food, and now the whole world knows it, or a significant portion of the world anyway. A few days ago, a Twitter user named John Becker asked Twitter's legions to post their most controversial food takes. There was the unusual hatred for mayonnaise, a takedown of lettuce, and even some swipes at peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. These are not that controversial. I decided to go for the gold and point out that I cannot stand the cuisine of over a billion people. And just to be annoying, I added that no one else could possibly like it either. I think Indian food is terrible, I said, and we pretend it isn't. The reactions at first were good-natured and funny. Do you not have taste buds? Top Chef Hope Padma Lak- Kishmi, I guess. Ask me. One of my Twitter acquaintances. One of my Twitter acquaintances called me the Donald Trump of food, a dagger in the heart for a widely known never Trumper like me. My friend and former student, prominent attorney and author Nir Cadel, simply posted Twitter's iconics repost. Unfollow. So, you know that wasn't all that happened. Other well-meaning but misguided people listed dozens of dishes. Others, however, saw a darker motive behind my inclusion of the expression, "we pretend it isn't." I was accused in various states of unhinged fury of playing into stereotypes about Indians and furthering a history of oppression. One woman raised Churchill and colonialism and the treatment of Indians in the British Empire. So, Justin, is this part of the patriarchy? Is this colonialism on display? Are you required morally, if you are white, to like Indian food, but not ever cook it? What say you?
I'm confused by the not ever cook it part. I'm not sure what that means.
Cooking it would be cultural appropriation, if you remember the story of the woman who started a small restaurant in, I think it was Washington, Seattle. And she started a food truck and was promptly run out of town for cultural appropriation.
Right. Okay, that makes sense. I understand that argument. Based upon living out here in California, in Southern California, in the Los Angeles, Orange County area, I think, yes, you are required to like this food and any other food from another culture in order to appear more worldly and open-minded, that you can't like white people food. And even I'm even being facetious saying that, right? Because there's no such thing as white people food, right? Because there's all, as we've talked about, a bunch of different white cultures. But I think Indian food is one of the top two examples of this. And this guy posted this, and I didn't think this was this controversial. Look, I'm going to get called racist, right? I'm going to get called a member of the patriarchy. I'm going to get called colonialist for this. But Indian food is terrible, okay? Any food that you need to cover up with a whole bunch of fucking sauce so you don't know what it actually tastes like is not good. And that's what this kind of food is. And you know what? It hurts going in. It hurts coming out. What worth is there in any of this food? And before I lived in California, I never heard about this kind of food being good. But then I lived out here and everyone was saying it was good. And then you hear about it on the Big Bang Theory all the time. Suddenly this kind of food became good. And it's the same thing with, what was I going to say? Crap. I lost my train of thought. Oh yeah. It's alongside this rise in diversity being important, in this virtue signaling about race. And this is just a form of virtue signaling about race. I mean, William, please bail me out here and tell me that you don't actually like Indian food.
Well, here's the thing with Indian food and the reason why every college person is the staple of their budget. It's cheap. It's very, very cheap. And you can use very cheap cuts of meat because you're using a lot of spices. And that's kind of historically what it was for. It's cheap.
Well, isn't that the purpose? That's my entire point. Isn't that the entire purpose of it? Because it comes from a country with a shitload of people who are fucking poor. So they need to be able to make cheap food that nourishes them in a certain way. Right? That's the history of it.
Yeah.
So
and
why do we pretend?
The spices, to not sound completely racist, Justin, the spices are also part of the history, right? The spices were cheap in India. As part of the spice trade.
Yeah, no, 100%.
So that's why
the region they're in, right? Right, it's the region they're in, right? 100%. I get everything you're saying, but let's be clear about this. This is where we don't have the proper discussions where we call things racist that aren't. This has nothing to do with race. This isn't like, oh man, Indians have a certain race, therefore their food is terrible. No, it's looking at the food and what it's composed of and how it's made and saying that that is not high quality. And that's got nothing to do with race. It could have been anyone that way. I mean, I'm even more extreme with this, William. I think the most overrated food on the planet is Mexican food. Explain to me what a burrito is besides a cheeseburger done in a less high quality way.
Well, I will tell you this. There are interesting cooking methods like the tandoori in India and the way they cook bread on it and things like that. There's lots to be learned from Indian cuisine and the combination of spices, things like that. But yeah, I think just if you go to any just standard Indian restaurant, it's not something I seek out. So I don't know if I agree with you 100% that it's terrible, but as someone who enjoys cooking, I do appropriate methods of cooking and spice combinations from Indian food. But I mean, as you know from the restaurant I own, I appropriate also from America. So,
well, and you know who you don't appropriate from is Mexican culture. I have no problem with what you just said. With creativity wise, I think Indian food is much more creative than Mexican food. That's why I'm not a big fan of Mexican food. Look, I don't hate Mexican food. If someone's like, let's have Mexican, I go, okay, I'm just going to have meat, cheese, and potatoes in a different form. It doesn't bother me. But if I had my choice, I'd rather have a cheeseburger. I'd rather have a steak. There are better ways of doing it. But yeah, Indian food is much more creative.
Yeah, you're not going to get this a lot of story, beef in though, Indian food.
Right. I mean, maybe that's part of why I hate it too, right? But there's a much more sort of insidious isn't really the right word, but there's a bigger undercurrent here. And this happens on social media and it happens on Twitter. And it's much more revealing of this story than the food part of it. These fucking tweets where they're like, post your most controversial food opinion. Post your most controversial comic book movie opinion. Post your most controversial music opinion. This is all for two purposes. One, it's so you can find your in-group and your in-group can rally around itself. And two, they're baiting people who they want to attack. This guy fell victim to this. He bought into it. Now, he either was trolling and wanted the attention, which he acknowledges to a certain extent, right? Where he said he was playing it up, you know, with the way he wrote it up. But
yeah,
he was baited. He was baited. They want people to say this so they can call people out. This is how the Twitter woke machine keeps going. You post things like this. Why? This is about social media in general that I don't understand. Why? What does this have to do? Why do you need to publicly share your opinion on food or share your opinion on Indian cuisine?
Well, I don't know.
If you're going to go eat with your family.
At least from the way he wrote the article, it looks like he was just shitposting, expecting his friends to shitpost back, right? And that I can understand. But you are in a public forum seen by millions of people. I'm not sure it's quite as large as what he talks about in the article, but yeah, you're going to get mob. This just provokes brigading and mob mentality.
Right, 100%. And no, shitposting I get. I understand that 100%. But even shitposting is a breaking down of culture. And what I mean by that is the people who are brigading and who are posting this are looking for someone to brigade. They're looking for someone to post this in earnest to brigade. So they're not participating in communication earnestly. Whereas they're hoping people
will. I think it's
will.
A little more than that, Justin, because I think they're looking to virtue signal.
I'm
brigading for the purpose of showing their white privilege.
100%. I agree with you 100%. And I'm saying that's not in earnest. Virtue signaling is not earnest communication. It's not earnest interaction. It's using other people to make yourself look better, quote unquote. And then now people are turning around and shitposting. So really, I mean, that's the proper reply, right? Like a shit post is a proper reply to that. But really, that makes no purpose in the entire exercise.
Well, yeah, no rational purpose. I mean, the purpose is to virtue signal.
Right. Right. But the shit posting is just to entertain yourself. And to me, there are better modes of entertainment out there. That's how you're going to entertain yourself, is just making fun of people on the internet?
Well, that is this podcast.
Yeah, but I do it once a week and I get money for it somewhat. Support our Patreon.
Patreon.com.
Our Patreon's been kind of dying a little bit. So if anyone out there has any feedback they'd like to give us as far as how to improve the show, I'd be willing to hear that rather than just turning this into a shit posting podcast. Because clearly, as what I just said, I don't want that.
Exactly.
But I mean, I think part of this is I just have a lot of angst. I have a lot of ennui over the rising death rate of white people, William.
Ah, that leads right into our next story. Death. Rising death rates among white Americans linked to perceived threat to their dominant social status, study says. A new public health study released by University of Toronto researchers found that rising mortality in white Americans is partly due to perceptions that they are losing social status. The paper, titled Growing Sense of Social Status Threat and Concomitant Deaths of Despair Among Whites.
Concomitant.
Sure. That's a needlessly academic word that does not belong in the title. Highlights.
Wait. This whole thing is needlessly academic. Why is someone from Toronto studying the death and social status of white Americans? What about white Canadians, Canada?
Well, this is the best part right here. Mortality rates seldom rise unless a society is subjected to something dangerous, like a major economic crisis, an infectious disease epidemic, or war. But there has been an increase in working age mortality rates for just one group in the United States since 1999, and that's non-Hispanic whites. Justin, question for you. What are Hispanic whites?
Well, technically, there are only three races. I don't remember what the three are. The three are like white, which is like Caucasian, and well, it might not be Caucasian, but the three are like white, African. I don't know if that's the proper word, and then like Asian. And it's based upon like hair follicle type, bone structure, all of that kind of stuff. But because Hispanics have similar, bone structure and hair follicles to, Caucasians, they're technically all white. So when you look at statistics of whites, the number of whites, you have to actually look at white non-Hispanics to see what people are talking about. But that's also why this racist collectivist shit is absurd, because you hear about white people all the time, you know, from the left, from the social justice warriors, and they're excluding Hispanics from that. But even though technically, based upon the model of race that was created scientifically, Hispanics are white. So the whole the definition in the common culture versus the academic culture, it's not even the same. So it's all absurd.
You know, it's funny. I was doing some research and realized, thanks to a commenter on an article, that in the UK academia, there's all these titles that seem a little bit misleading when you realize what they're doing. They'll talk about how such and such affects Asians and blah, 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 and blah, blah, blah. And they name these groups. You're thinking, Asians? That's really weird, because, you know, we talk about how in the United States, most of the Asian populations are overrepresented in positive ways, right? Asian just means Middle Eastern to them. They lump all of that together. So they don't refer to folks from the Middle East as being from the Middle East. So it's all just Asian. So that way the numbers come back down. I don't know. It just seems really weird. So you have to always parse it. If you see something from the UK or Europe, they'll talk about Asians, and that's their code word for Middle Eastern.
Yeah, and that's part of the whole weird system that's going on now. Like, people from India are technically Asian. Because India is in Asia. So some people from India want to be referred to as Asian. Some people don't, because Asian is more associated in the U.S. with being Oriental. Oh, no, I just said the word Oriental. So all of this is very confusing. But this is ultimately why collectivism is such a sham, because all of these are largely arbitrary categories just to figure out demographics. And I mean, even this study, right? This study, can you explain to me something, William? From a scientific perspective, how do mortality rates change? Because I was under the impression that the mortality rate for human beings is 100%.
Well, I think here the rate refers to when it happens. So the rate in each age segment. So if you die earlier, then the rate is higher. And if you die later,
okay,
then
so
it's
then
lower.
Can you explain to me something else?
Sure.
How does perceived threat to social status lead to mortality? Well, are more people committing suicide?
The article points out it's deaths of despair. So while mortality rates trend higher for whites, the increased causes of death have been due to alcohol consumption, opioid use, opioid overuse, and suicides. According to the study, rising chronic diseases, which include hypertension and obesity, also contributed to this trend. So, Justin, yeah, people are getting fat and high on opioids.
Aren't they then making an illegitimate link here to social status? I mean, there could be any number of causes of these things, right? I mean, we know the issues with the opioid epidemic, with the overprescription of pain pills. You know, I think there's a culture of alcoholism in this country, and I certainly don't think that's limited to race, and I don't think that has to do with social status. And then what was the other thing you said? The obesity? I mean, that's been talked about at length. So it seems
ironically,
like the
article lists at the beginning the actual causes, right? Economic crisis, infectious disease, epidemic, and war, right? We had, let's think historically for a minute. We sent a lot of people into dangerous zones in the last 10, 15 years, right? That's going to contribute to it because disproportionately these are going to be poor economic folks, right? So I'm sure that's a contributing factor. We also know that the opioid epidemic has a lot of complex causes, and I know Dr. Drew has talked a lot about this. As to why it's affecting like rural areas more is really interesting. I think there's a documentary on it. I can't remember the name off the top of my head. But I know Dr. Drew's in it. You could probably find it on IMDb. I think blaming this on white angst is really weird, right? Like, for me, it would seem like white angst would be caused by social justice, right? Because this like obsession with looking at things in the racial lens would cause people who have bad circumstances happen to them to look at it in that lens. I mean, Adam Carolla always gives that example of one of his white privileges is knowing when he moves in next to a asshole neighbor that they're just an asshole and not racist. Because if he was black, it would be super easy to go with the narrative and just say, oh, it's just because they're racist, when really they're just an asshole.
Isn't that the wish fulfillment of this conclusion of this study? Don't they want white people to be just as obsessed with race as everyone else? Because then they win, because then they've made the conversation about race. Isn't that the point of this finding? To try and say that it's because white people are obsessed with race too? And ultimately, it's probably projection, because the name of the doctor who completed this study, I believe, is a very white name as well, correct?
Yeah, I think we could just rename this study Confirmation Bias, the study.
So. Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I think the thing that really is important to what you said is, I think a lot of the problems that you've noted, you said it, are low-class people. And I believe I've talked about it on the show before. I don't consider class to be about economics. I don't consider class to be about like your social caste, if you will. I mean, we were just talking about Indian food, so I'm going to use that term. I consider class to be the way you conduct yourself and the way you value your life. So even if you don't make a lot of money, if you take care of yourself and you act in a way with a lot of integrity, I consider that high class. You know, a low class person is somebody who it's just they're grating to be around because of the way they handle themselves. The way they interact with other people.
Yeah, how they treat themselves and others. It's the behaviors.
Right. So I think a lot of these are associated with low class, right? When you talk about obesity, well, that's not handling yourself well. When you talk about the opioid epidemic, that's not handling yourself well. Hypertension, getting stressed out all the time, that's not taking care of yourself well. So I think a lot of these are associated with low-class lifestyle, and I don't think that has to do with race. I think you would see that across anyone who treated themselves that way, and I think that's the real undercurrent of this study.
Wow. Blaming the victim, Justin. I mean, that's what
that's all I do. I always just blame the victim. I mean, that's my whole life. I love, by the way, a brief tangent here. I love how I can blame the victim with anything and it's wrong, except if it's about myself. So if I blame myself, nobody argues with
me. White
right?
people.
And I'm like, right. Well, I'm not saying I'm poor. I'm not saying like I'm not playing victimhood here. But what I'm saying is, if I blame the victim in any other case, people are like, don't do that, blah, blah, blah. But if like somebody gets mad at me when they're the ones who are wrong, and then I go, you know what? It's actually, it's my fault. I'm such a fuck up. I'm terrible. Nobody argues with me.
I'm going to get that drop. Nobody argues with me.
I think people would argue with me over the next story, though, because I'm going to have a...
You're going to have a hot take? Speaking
of
hot.
I'm going to have a hot take.
Watching pornography rewires the brain to a more juvenile state. Pornography has existed throughout recorded history, transforming with the introduction of each new medium. Hundreds of sexually explicit sculptures were found in the Mount Vesuvius ruins of Pompeii. Since the advent of the internet, porn uses skyrocketed to dizzying heights. Pornhub, the world's largest free porn site, served over 33.5 billion site visits during 2018 alone. Science is only just beginning to reveal the neurological repercussions of porn consumption, but it is already clear that the mental health and sex lives of its widespread audience are suffering catastrophic effects. From depression to erectile dysfunction, porn addiction appears to be hijacking our neurowiring with dire consequences. So, Justin, what are the impacts of porn consumption?
I think this article... it is pretty spot on. I find it interesting that it's saying it's returning you to a childlike state. I don't know how true that is. I don't know how many children are like desensitized to sexuality. So I'm not sure about that. And that's not what they're saying, right? What are they saying when they're saying this, that it rewires the brain to a more juvenile state?
Well, they talk about in the article that, some of the effects of it are, because you go to porn for that satisfaction of that desire, you're actually sort of conditioning yourself to expect that is the place where you get it from.
Right, and is that more juvenile? Is that what they're saying?
Yeah, I wasn't 100% sure how they got to juvenile exactly, because the other example they talk about is sort of the instant gratification. So I think that's more...
That's the more juvenile.
Yeah, I think that's the juvenile connection.
Right, the juvenile connection is, and again, this is an Adam Carolla thing, right? He talks about the study where people who are more willing to delay gratification are more successful in life. And that would be true about sexuality as well, right? If you're willing to delay gratification, and what I mean by that is to build a relationship with someone, to build a connection with someone, to build intimacy with someone, that sexual experience will then be better in the long run. Now, I'm not advocating monogamy or anything of that nature. I'm not going that far down the rabbit hole. But what I'm saying is the sexual experience is better when it's with another person, and it's with another person you have some sort of a connection or bond you've built with. And the reason I'm saying this is I also want to differentiate between someone who just goes on an app and is like, oh yeah, I'm going to swipe right on that person and then go there and have sex one night and come back. Now, I'm not saying you shouldn't watch porn, and I'm not saying you shouldn't do the connection, those one night stand type things. I'm not making that sort of a moral statement. I'm sort of talking about like eating fast food versus eating a well-cooked meal. Is what I'm talking about, right? I'm not saying it's immoral to watch a Marvel movie. I'm not saying it's immoral to watch porn. I'm not saying it's immoral to have a one-night stand to eat fast food. But what I am saying is what is better and what is higher quality. And it's clearly higher quality to have that connection for the sexual experience. And I think that the point about conditioning is spot on. Because my experience, if I've ever watched porn in my life, is the desensitization in that way. I don't like to watch it because it does. It conditions you to think that this is what you have to enjoy and this is what it has to be like. And because you're just a passive observer, right? When you're watching porn, you're watching, right? You're not participating. So it conditions you to be a passive observer and not a participant and not an expressor of your own desire and your own worth. In a way, you could even argue that porn makes it so you associate, you condition yourself to think that sexuality is a selfless thing. It's about other people and not about yourself. It's about other people enjoying themselves and not yourself, which undermines it completely. So I think this article is very spot on, and I'm trying to be careful with what I'm saying because I don't want to come across very
you're
Protestant
Puritan.
Or what's the proper word?
Yeah,
Puritan. It was one of those P words. I don't want to come across very puritanical because I'm saying engage in sexuality, but engage in it in the best way possible. And I think this article very much points out the conditioning aspect of it, because all of our behaviors condition us, right? Think about it, William. Let's go back to the metaphor of fast food. Let's go back to the metaphor of Marvel movies. If that's what you get used to watching, isn't it then going to be harder for your body to, or eating, isn't it going to be harder for your body to digest high quality food when you go and eat it? I know when I don't eat fast food for a long time and then I go eat it, I have a hard time digesting that. It destroys me. It's very quick. It goes through me very quickly. I get an upset stomach. But if I eat it over a longer period of time, my body gets conditioned to it and I can process that. It's the same thing like if you're only used to watching Marvel movies and then you go and you try to watch The Irishman, we see all the people complaining about The Irishman and how it's too long and all these other issues, even though they didn't have a problem with the 3-hour length of Infinity War or Endgame. So I think the point about conditioning yourself, conditioning being the 80-20 rule, what you do 80% of the time is what your body gets used to. And you have to ask yourself, what's your body? What's your mind? What do you want to do 80% of the time to create the life you want? And most people will engage in these behaviors. And I think this article is a perfect example of that. Do you think I'm talking crazy here, William?
No, not at all. I too am tired of people complaining that my sex is too long. So, yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Just like anything that you can do that involves pleasure, there's destructive and non-destructive ways to engage with it. Right. And, I think there's a lot of people, I think men in particular, especially as they're growing up, they have to figure out this relationship with their sexuality. And it's sad. At the risk of sounding puritanical, I've never been someone who can just randomly hook up with a stranger. And that's pretty common in gay culture. And it's just something I've never been able to engage with. And
I don't think it's just like, common in gay culture. I don't know the number of straight men who are doing it, but in the advent of apps, William, I think it's very easy for attractive women to do that in the year 2019. And I think that it's something that's not discussed enough, that women, because of the way the sexual market favors them, right, from an economic standpoint, right, they're the ones who there's the demand for. They can very easily just find an attractive stranger and have sex with them. And what does it do to them? And then what does that do overall to the way our relationships are? I mean, it sounds like you've witnessed firsthand what hooking up with a random stranger does to relationships in gay culture.
Yeah. Yeah. It makes it very transactional and disconnected from reality. It's very
well.
Strange.
And then Hal, let me ask you this. Now, I don't know your experiences and everything. I'm assuming you don't really do that, but for someone who does do that and then they try to be in a serious relationship and an intimate relationship with someone they actually connect with, doesn't it? I would assume it becomes harder for that person once they're in that relationship because of how they're used to treating sexuality.
Yeah, I can definitely see that happening. There's so much more when you're in a relationship about the give and take and the way you discuss things and, you know, all sorts of things that happen over a long-term relationship that you're just not prepared for if, you know, all you're doing is hooking up.
I agree. Is there anything else you want to say about this story, or would you like to move on to backlash against Black Friday?
Yeah. Speaking of transactional, French activists protest.
There's the transition. There's the transition. French and transactional. That hits the sex and the transaction.
French activists protest against Amazon in Black Friday backlash. Activists stage protests against online retailer Amazon around France on Friday, denouncing the rampant consumerism typified by the annual Black Friday shopping frenzy. French companies have embraced Black Friday, named for the sales held on the first Friday after the U.S. Thanksgiving holiday, when retailers typically heavily discount their goods to spur business. However, there has been some backlash against the event, driven in part by environmental concerns. So, Justin, how many plastic straws did you buy on Black Friday?
I don't buy plastic straws, William. What I do is when I go to like a fast food restaurant or a Sam's Club and I buy food, like, so say I'm at Dunkin' Donuts and I buy a couple donuts, I will then, when I go over to their counter with plastic straws, I'll take five instead of taking one, just to stock up, because I know one day those won't be available so much. So that's how I do that. I think the environmental concern, though, is just there are more human beings out being active. Therefore, it's creating worse conditions for the environment. I think that's their argument, is it not?
Yeah, I think so, because otherwise it doesn't make sense, because obviously Amazon's delivering goods much cheaper than otherwise, and that usually is strongly correlated with less, quote-unquote, environmental impact. So it's really...
Well, wouldn't there also be less environmental impact from an online retailer versus a store? Because you have to keep the store running, people have to travel to the store, whereas if there's one person traveling and that driver is delivering packages to a bunch of different places, now that creates some sort of a footprint because of the truck traveling all over. But that's better than each person traveling in their unique car to wherever they're going to buy the good.
Yeah, but you're making the error of looking at this in terms of humans, and humans are not part of nature according to environmentalism, so we cannot look at this in terms of human flourishing. That's the incorrect frame. They talk about Amazon spurring overconsumption, which kind of doesn't make any sense. What does even overconsumption mean, Justin?
Well, overconsumption, in my perspective, is just an arbitrary standard they've set where they decide what each person should consume or not. And when you consume over that, they say you're over-consuming. Is that your understanding of it as well?
I think so. I think the reason they use overconsumption is because the term waste would be way more obvious to see the actual fact that they think any consumption is waste, is evil.
Well, and that's the problem I've had in general, to open this conversation up a little bit more. The problem I've had in general with the left my entire life and with the social justice warriors my entire life before they became a thing, I am so tired of other people setting the terms of conversation, and then when I call them out on it, they tell me I'm crazy. Look, I'm not stupid. I know what you're doing. Everyone does this thing nowadays where they reframe everything to make themselves seem like the good guy and make everyone else seem like the bad guy. And this is the perfect example of it. By simply setting the term overconsumption, you're already having the discussion about how much you should consume.
Yeah, it's always great to use that trick sort of against them, right? You ask them about the frame and how they know that's the right frame, and where did they get that frame from, and what are its implications? You make the conversation epistemological, right? Because...
And in my experience, William, when you do that, I think you are 100% correct, but my experience when you do that is they have no idea what to say, because most people, and I'm talking about the majority of people here. William, my degree from FU says you are 100% correct.
I had that. Sorry, yes, I'm juggling exactly too many windows since I'm doing 2x the duty today.
You will be paid two times nothing for this episode as well, just as always. But no, it's most people have been trained to just use this technique, but not understand the ideas behind it. So I find out when you call them out on it, it just becomes an attack at that point. And it just becomes negative and it becomes a fight and there's no more conversation.
Well, I know in my experience, depending on when you exit the conversation, like the epistemological way is the way to go, right? Because you chip away, maybe not in that moment, but you're chipping away at how they're thinking about it and not challenging their conclusions and values directly. And that may seem like a cop-out at first, but we know philosophically, epistemology is way down deep, right? And you're chopping at the roots of their ideas and how they're thinking about things. And that can take time to have impact, but getting people to think in that frame or to engage in conversation in that frame over time, I think is an effective way of making a difference.
And the overtime is such an important point. And it's something that I wish the people fighting back would remember, because this story is such a perfect example of what is actually going on here. It embodies the issues and the conflicts at stake in the current global culture. This is a fight against Americanism, because when globalization happens, one culture, one ideology, one way of thinking must become the dominant culture across the world. And what is going on is people are fighting against Americanism being that culture that leads the globe. And when you look at it, it's France rebelling against consumerism. Could you embody that any better? Of course the French hate Americans. And that's what's really going on. They don't want that American style of life to take over theirs. And that's what we're seeing with all of these things, all of the stories we talk about every week. It's just rebelling and fighting against Americanism and trying to tear it down. And it's something that has been going on since the beginning of time, almost, and certainly since the founding of America.
Wow.
And these seeds were planted back then.
There were cave paintings, anti-American cave paintings. This is amazing.
I'm being when I'm saying American, I'm using that as very much shorthand for a certain style of life, and for me it very much means individualism. Yeah. Is what I'm really saying. Nothing, William, you're good.
I'm
standing
good.
Pat now. Right, I wasn't sure. I thought you might have something else to say, so I was pausing for a brief moment
to
see if you had anything
pause.
To say. It wasn't a dramatic pause. It was a production pause. But let's just move on. We'll go on to the next segment here where we've got a review going on. The review sort of deals with individualism. And then we got some trailers to talk about coming up. It's time for The Hopeful Romantic with JML. Put me into syndication. Broadcast to a network station of people viewing their favorite episodes. I can't find a new pitch to throw the studio. As I say every week, if you want to continue to participate in this conversation and make the conversation more two ways, you can join our Discord channel. You can do that by going to themidside.com or themidside.com/podcast. When you go there, there's a link to the Discord channel. Click on it, and then you can contribute to the episodes. Trailer Takedown Dan posted a great video for Belichick Your Premises about get back coaches, which unfortunately we're going to have to wait till next week to discuss. Get back coaches are near to my heart because of Clemson, but we're going to talk about that next week. But content like that is greatly appreciated, and it adds to the episode. For instance, this next movie that I'm going to review was suggested. The trailer was suggested by a midsider in Discord, kept pushing in. I finally watched the trailer and then I saw the movie. So I looked at what was playing in theaters and decided to see Jojo Rabbit. Jojo Rabbit is, of course, the satirical movie written and directed and co-starring I can't say his name, but the director and writer of Thor Ragnarok. In it, he plays Hitler, who is the imaginary friend of a 10-year-old boy during World War II living in Germany, even though the movie's actually shot in Prague. Prague subs in for Germany in this movie. And this 10-year-old is trying to become a member of the Nazi party. He's trying to fight in the war. But things happen and he's not able to. He accidentally blows up a grenade and, he gets scars on his face and he develops a limp. So he has to stay home and help that way. But while he's home, his mother, who he's living with because his dad has gone off to war, he finds out that his mother has been working with the resistance against the Nazi party and also housing a Jew. There's a young Jewish girl living in the crawl space of his house. And through getting to know this Jewish girl, he predictably learns that, racism is bad. So on one hand, this movie, I don't really have that much bad to say about it. Like, it's pretty innocuous. When we talked about the trailer, I talked about sort of the context of why are we so obsessed with Nazis nowadays. It's sort of offensive to link Nazis to what's going on in this country because it underplays what actual evil is. Fortunately, if you divorce this movie from the context of our culture, there's nothing in it. There's no parallels to Americanism. This is just a satire of Nazism. It's making fun of Nazis and the racism and showing how it affected, a 10-year-old boy. So there's that side of it, which, it's enjoyable from that perspective. But there is sort of like this undercurrent to it. Undercurrent's not even the right word. Part of the problem I have, and William, I think you'll appreciate this critique, especially because you're always complaining about sci-fi and how there's not enough good sci-fi. The problem I have with this movie is when I watch it, it just reminds me that the best and the brightest are not working in Hollywood. We're not getting the best storytellers. And what I mean by that is I'm not saying I am the best storyteller, but if I can watch the ending and immediately go, here's how you could tweak that ending subtly and you would get a much better ending, then that tells me that the execution is not as good as it could be. It's sort of like if you're watching football and somebody does a play call and you're like, okay, I could have game planned that better. I could have played that, or I could have called that play better. If I can, sitting on my couch, call the play better, well, maybe you guys need to hire a better coach, better play callers. It's the same thing here. A lot of this was good conceptually. So, spoiler here, if you want to hit the spoiler drop.
There's walkers in the barn and Lori's pregnant.
There we go. So, one of the refrains in this movie is, dancing is the purest form of freedom. So, you get to the end of the movie and his mother's been killed because they found out she's in the resistance. And she's been hung, and he's established this bond. He's 10. This girl's like 21. He's established this bond with the Jewish girl, and the Allies come in. They win the war. They free Berlin or whatever. I think they were Berlin. I don't remember what city they were in. I don't think it was Berlin, but they free the city, and he lies to the girl. He says, no, I'm sorry. The Nazis won the war. And then he lets her go. He's like, okay, I have a plan for you to escape, though. She goes outside and finds out that he lied, slaps him, and then they dance. And the movie ends. It doesn't make any sense because we don't know if his dad's coming back. His mom's dead. He's all on his own. And the entire movie had this disintegrated thing of what Hitler represented, his imaginary Hitler represented to his psychology. Now, the way it was done, it was like, the Hitler character wasn't in there enough, and it was almost just in there. So at the end, he could kick him out and be like, no, I don't need you anymore. You're evil. Which, it's compelling. The idea that, oh, hey, he learns that the Nazis aren't the way to go. But what would have been more compelling is if it had shown that his lack of self-esteem is what made him susceptible to this collectivistic way of thinking. So then at the end, rather than lying to the girl because he didn't want her to leave, because obviously that's why he lied to her, because he didn't want to be alone, right? He didn't want her to leave because the war was over, because he admitted that he loved her, and she admitted she loved him as a younger brother, even though they're not related. So he has to lie to her. If at the end he said, they won, we, you know, the Nazis lost, you're free, but could you please stay because I have no one and I need you, that would have been a much stronger ending, and you still could have had the dancing because she could have taken over the role of the mother, because the mother is who originally told him the dancing thing. So if she had said, okay, I'll stay, and she said, come outside with me, and they go outside and they dance, the ending would have been much more powerful, because you would have had the parallels with the mother, you would have had the idea of the love between two people who are individuals and learn, even though one's a Nazi and one's Jewish, and they learn and they overcome through all of this, and they can be stronger post-war because of the bonds through tension. So look, this isn't a bad movie. It just could have been done a lot better than it was. So I would say you should see this if, you know, you just want a sort of a simple, inoffensive comedy about Nazis. You shouldn't see this if, you know, if you have a list of better things to watch and there are things that are more inspiring to watch, then watch that. I only saw this because there's not much in theaters. There's a big lull in theaters right now till The Rise of Skywalker comes out. So I saw it. All right, let's now move on to Trailer Takedown. As always, I post the trailers on the website on Saturday mornings at the latest. You can go there to themidside.com or themidside.com/podcast, and you can watch the trailers before the episode, after the episode, or I personally would do it alternatingly. I would watch a trailer and then have us talk about it, watch a trailer and then have us talk about it.
Trailer Takedown. First trailer.
The Walking Dead World Beyond is the second spinoff of The Walking Dead. I can't tell what's different about this trailer than from the other two stories of The Walking Dead. The only thing is it seems like this might be more positive, sort of like more focused on kids and how they're going to grow up in the world and make the world better post-zombie apocalypse, whereas the other two Walking Dead series are very dour and naturalistic, especially the first Walking Dead spinoff. Fear the Walking Dead is very naturalistic. You know, that was my review from the beginning when they start arguing about like the superiority of nature over mankind, and I don't mean nature as sort of the environment. I just mean, you know, the world and the way existence is has power over man. Man doesn't have power over his existence. And the second one, or the original, has always been just about the repeating cycle of coming up against tyrants and evil people and more people dying because of it. It's just different faces to that, you know, those tyrants and those evil people. As far as this one, it doesn't seem that different. I mean, part of me is like, hey, yeah, maybe it's different. It's more positive. But it's probably going to be more of the same. So I don't really see much of a reason to get excited about this. The Walking Dead is a franchise that's existing on vapors at this point, at fumes, I think. I mean, back in the day, we had Star Trek and Star Wars, which were the amazing franchises. You know, we have Harry Potter now. The Walking Dead could have been that, but they just didn't have the conceptual underpinnings in order to continue to do that, so I'm not going to engage with this. Tackle? William?
You know, I got a bit of the visual style of The Handmaid's Tale, and I'm not exactly sure why. Maybe it's the sort of, like you were saying, some of the dystopian stuff from it. You know, this,
well, yeah, the female character, I don't know who that actress is, but the adult who comes in at the end, she very much has a dystopian vibe to her with her black clothing, yeah, and her pin on her shirt. So it almost seems like maybe the kids are going to overcome this dystopian world. So that's where the sort of the sense of hope may come in.
Maybe. But, unlike you, I never got sucked in by The Walking Dead. There was very little that looked interesting here that I couldn't get from other better stories. So I will
tackle. Second trailer.
Dispatches from Elsewhere. Let me say that again, because that's tough to say. Dispatches from Elsewhere. I love when they make their television show titles hard to say. It's like, how am I going to talk about this at the water cooler? It's an AMC series. I don't know if it's limited or not, but it seems like people are picked to become part of this underground group that's influencing society. And they're told it's a game, but they become unsure if it's a game or not. And they start arguing amongst themselves and really questioning what's going on. This story is very appealing to me when you look at the context of our society, especially things like the Epstein quote unquote suicide, you know, the Epstein didn't kill himself meme. Are there elites? Is there an underground world that's part within our world that is influencing and shaping things? This show looks like it could really be addressing that and bringing that to the forefront. It looks like it's well done. It's got a good cast. I like the way it looks. I think this show could secretly be one of the better things to come out of our culture in a long time, and it may not be talked about, but I am definitely, definitely, definitely going to be giving this a chance because of that. Hug. William?
Yeah, this seemed, at first I thought this was going in a Twilight Zone direction, right? And then it sort of morphed into a story that I think I would be interested in. So, what was the show about the hacker that was crazy? You never really knew if he was in reality or not.
Oh, Mr. Robot?
Yeah, Mr. Robot. I got some Mr. Robot vibes from this. And I sort of stopped watching Mr. Robot.
Became a show about like socialism and communism and tearing the system down.
Yeah.
Whereas this looks like, because there were lines in there like, what if this is all the government just manipulating society? This looks like, yeah, it could be the inverse Mr. Robot, yeah. Right? Showing the way government is manipulating society and we don't even realize it.
Yep. So I'm in. Hug.
Hug.
I also agree with you. Okay, well, you can hit that again in 2 seconds. Yep. But I also agree with you that it really reminded me of the Twilight Zone at first, but then I was glad to see it was something else.
Yeah, I was really glad.
Third trailer.
Beyond the Law is a Steven Seagal DMX movie, and I don't know where it's going to be released. It's not a sequel to Above the Law, although that would have been nice. I don't really know what they're doing in this movie. I think maybe they're saving a kid. This is sort of a combination of Steven Seagal's early work in the 80s and then his work in the 90s, where like he did movies with DMX and Ja Rule. The whole like, oh, let's pair Steven Seagal with a rapper now to make him relevant. I want to like this because I like Steven Seagal's work in the 80s. But I don't think 80s movies can work nowadays because I think our society has gone too far to leftist naturalism to properly execute the pulp romanticism of 80s Steven Seagal and Jean-Claude Van Damme and action and martial arts movies. So as much as I want to like this and I want to have hope for this, I don't have the time and I don't have the energy and the emotion to invest hope in this. Tackle. William?
I got the same reaction. I was like, all this makes me want to do is watch an 80s Steven Seagal movie where he's 100 pounds lighter. So, tackle.
Final trailer.
The Last Measure is a Vietnam War movie, except it's about after the Vietnam War, or maybe they intersplice scenes from the war with the present investigation. So it seems to be about a hero of his troop who never was recognized. So Sebastian Stan plays a guy who's investigating whether this person deserves a Medal of Valor or not. That in itself is completely uninteresting to me. I was wondering if Daniel was going to find that interesting, but I don't really want to see like a government employee investigating whether somebody deserves a honor from the government. And supposedly the government agent is going to be exposing the corruption within the government. This is an old trope that's been done over and over again. This is, you know, oh, the journalist is so noble. Oh, you know, the government agent is so noble. This is sort of done in a way with the recent movie starring Mark Ruffalo, where he's a corporate lawyer and then he has to become noble when he's investigating DuPont. So this trope has been done over and over again. And then this trailer just drags on. At a certain point, I'm like, why is this trailer still going? I've got what this movie is about. All you're doing is making this seem less interesting by showing more scenes that are just this guy talking to people and this guy investigating through talking to people. So this trailer actually, with the way it's cut and its length, makes it so I'm less likely to see this movie after a certain point. Tackle. William?
Is this movie just to try and beef up our opinion of journalists before the election? You know, dredge up Vietnam, you know, that the media sees that as one of their big successes, right? I don't know.
Vietnam was really when the media saw themselves as changing the culture, because they believe that they're the ones who made it so we didn't defeat communism in that theater in the world. They think they're the ones who fought back against the government and fought back about Americanism. You could really see that as a major turning point. And that's what I mean, where it's a tired trope. How much are they going to tell this story over and over again?
I don't know. It didn't seem interesting. And oh my God, the trailer just wouldn't end. So no.
Tackle.
All right, William, that brings an end to this journey into the midside. Let's put a bow on this episode. Let's wrap it up. What did we learn this trip?
Boycotting all French products from Amazon in the name of environmentalism this Christmas. Justin, what did you learn?
What did the French make? What is the number one export of France? Pornography?
Wine-related?
We've already learned why not to watch pornography, right? What did you say the number one export was?
It's probably wine. It's certainly not Fiat's.
Yeah, there's plenty of... Just get Italian wine, right? Or get wine from Northern California, right? There's plenty of other places to get wine. So...
All right, Justin, what did you learn?
I learned that I'm going to die earlier because I have anxiety about my social status. Because I spend all of my life thinking about where I fit in with other people.
Well, if you have anxiety about your social status, bring it up a notch by visiting our website at themidside.com. You can see our past episodes. Make sure you go to patreon.com/themidside and sign up for giving us a small little tip every episode so that we can keep the lights on. And don't forget to check BitChute. We have a new video out. Justin put a new video out that's really interesting. Unfortunately, it angered the Susanna, the YouTube gods. So it's easier to find on BitChute right now.
And wait, why'd you use the name Susanna?
That's a meme on YouTube about Susan, the CEO of YouTube. We call the algorithm Susanna.
Okay. Well, that's interesting because so it's a video on 300 and analyzing it, and literally YouTube rejected it and was like, if you eliminate 10 of these 11 minutes, then it won't fit a copyright strike. But the whole thing is an educational piece. It's an analytical piece, and none of the scenes play for an extended period of time, just the scene, right? Either there's dialogue over it or they're remixed in a way to make an analytical point, or you know, some of the dialogue plays at a certain point. So none of it is any sort of thing that actually is violating copyright. And it's in fact, people who watch the video who haven't seen the movie should be inspired to go watch the movie. And it should make you, if you have seen it, watch it again. So it would actually favor them. It's like a marketing piece for them almost. So it's very strange that it was rejected for copyright. I believe there are other reasons it was rejected. I don't really believe it was copyright. I'm more with you, William, where I think they're rejecting it for intellectual reasons, ideological reasons. I think they saw what the video was about because
Susanna,
it was originally posted.
All-knowing.
It was originally posted. And then like 15 minutes later, it was rejected for copyright. It's like, okay, someone totally watched that video and was like, nope, this one's not going to see the light of day. So I haven't shared the video link publicly except in Discord. Another reason to join Discord ahead of time. But I will be posting it on Twitter tomorrow. So look for the link. Well, when this episode's out. So when this episode is out, look for the twink. Look for the link on Twitter. Don't look for the twink. That creates
that's
some weird
different
subtext.
Activity. And
that's
one
a different
final
activity. And what we learned is you don't want to participate in that activity.
That's right. One final shout out to our Liberty.me syndication. Hey, guys. And that's it for me.
This concludes your journey into the midside. I'm Justin M. Lesneski reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Don't have Indian food today.
I don't know if you heard, but during my final like explanation there of the video, the cat started like scratching the chair behind me and started yelling, and it was just so distracting.